The story is really interesting, and it really launched me sort of on this career. What happened was the following. I was working for the Americans. The Wiesenthal Center had filed a Freedom of Information Act in the U.S. Asking for any information relating to Joseph Mengele and his various known aliases. They received a document. I think that was in 1984. It's written about in the book, and I was aware about this in the book.
Right.
So they received a document indicating that Mengele had been arrested and released by the Americans near Vienna after the war.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So Reagan made the following decision. The United States of America would search for Joseph Mengele. The United States of America would determine whether Mengele had ever entered the United States. And the United States of America would launch a historical investigation to determine whether or not this information was actually accurate. And that historical investigation was entrusted to the OSR. Mm-hmm. And I was one of the people who was actively involved in this investigation. And one of the assignments that I received was to try and find the whereabouts of a Holocaust survivor named David Freiman.
Okay.
Who was assigned to Mengele's laboratory at Auschwitz and had survived the Shoah. And he apparently was the source of the information that Mengele had been arrested and released by the Americans. In other words, the Wiesenthal Center took this information that Mengele had been arrested and released by the Americans, turned it into a scandal, as only the Wiesenthal Center is capable of doing. And in response, the Reagan made those three decisions. Now, when, you know, I did almost all my work at Yad Vashem, and I was discussing this with a friend of mine at Yad Vashem named David Silverklein. You know David.
Yeah. Okay. So and at the moment, you're not an employee of the Sun and Business Center, but you had been.
I had been. Yeah. I had been in 78-80.
Right.
But no, actually, I was doing radio reports for them for their weekly radio show. But it wasn't, you know, it was very peripheral. So David said to me, "Why don't you look in the files of the ITS, that's the International Tracing Service." Now, the International Tracing Service was, today you call it a database. In those days, there was no database. In other words, the Red Cross received millions of requests for information after the war on people who had been in Europe during World War II, some of whom survived, some of whom perished. But this was not necessarily restricted to Jews. In other words, there were millions of requests. So what they did was they basically obligated any person who wanted a status as a refugee with the International Refugee Organization, which accorded certain privileges, they had to, in other words, they basically registered their data. And that data went into the collection of information on individuals who had lived through, who had been in Europe during World War II. Now, the information itself did not in any way point to people as Nazi war criminals.
Right.
No, but listen. My initial assumption was that the ITS was in, the files of the ITS were in Yad Vashem. Okay? Now, the funny thing about this whole story is this. During the last year and a half, there's been a whole hullabaloo about the release of the Arrowson documents.
Right.
Okay? But what no one knows, or almost no one knows, is that the Arrowson documents have, a significant portion, including the files of the ITS, have been available at Yad Vashem for the last 50 years. Because anyone who applied for access to Arrowson got the runaround. In other words, there was no access for anybody, really. But all you had to do was go to Yad Vashem, and you had your full access to the ITS. And I actually used that ITS to find hundreds of Nazis. But we'll get to that in a second. I'll explain how it worked. So I said to David, "I'm looking for this guy, David Freiman." He got an ad, you know, a star was talking, was standing around talking. So he said, "Why don't you look in the files of the ITS?" Okay. Now, my impression at that point, my mistaken impression, I should say, was that the ITS had the files only of Jewish survivors. Okay? Now, the information is arranged alphabetically, but it's not the standard ABC. In other words, it's not the standard alphabet. It's arranged phonetically.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes you a while until you get the hang of it. In other words, Y's are I's, V's are W's, or W's are V's, something like that. So in other words, it took me a while. I had to go through hundreds or dozens of entries until I found what I was looking for. And that, of course, shattered my illusion that this was only Jews. In other words, it was clear to me that there were, you know, tons of non-Jews. So this immediately lit a red light in my mind. And I said like this, we know from previous research that Nazi war criminals registered under their own names, emigrated to the West posing as innocent refugees. If that's the case, and we know it's the case, in theory, this archive is a gold mine because among, in other words, the biographical details listed on the people is where they emigrated to.
Okay.
What boat, what date. In other words, this was an unbelievable find. So I made a little experiment. And I took 50 names of Lithuanians and Latvians who I knew were involved in war crimes. And I looked for them in the files of the ITS. Lo and behold, 20 of the 50 were listed. And the beauty of it was, not only were they listed, it said where they went.
Hmm.
So all of a sudden, I basically was sitting on a gold mine. Now, since among the people who we found, since among these people were individuals who went to countries other than the United States, like Australia and Canada, primarily, it was clear to me that this information had implications way beyond my job as a researcher for OSI.